Hi, this is David DeSmith. Welcome to an interview with Ian Anderson. For over 40 years, you've known him as the frontman and creative force behind legendary rock band Jethro Tull. Currently, he's touring and performing Thick as a Brick 2, aka Tab 2, the sequel to his eponymously named 1972 progressive rock album, which climbed to number one on the charts within moments of appearing on record store shelves. In this interview, which was conducted in May of 2013, Ian shares his thoughts about the sequel, his current global tour, his approach to songwriting, and what fans can expect next from this brilliant and outspoken artist. Ian, thanks for taking time to chat.
No problem.
I know you've been maintaining a pretty demanding tour schedule since Tab 2 debuted last year. How are you feeling? All the parts still functioning as they should?
Yeah, pretty well. I mean, I thought you were going to say been maintaining a pretty serious schedule since 1968. But yes, last year, yes, it's we started touring. I think it was a Brick production tours in April last year, so it's just over a year we've been doing these shows. We have a few shows coming up in June and two in August, which are just more general best of repertoire, but I think we will have clocked up about 200 concerts of Thick as a Brick 2 when we draw that to a conclusion in the in November this year.
Right.
So
right.
Yes, it's been it's been an interesting commitment to doing to all the detail, really, of doing a show where everything is kind of in place every night. And I've not done that before to this extent, where it has been a an unwavering arrangement. I mean, obviously, the little areas of improvisation that all of us have in certain bits and pieces throughout the show, but you know, bar for bar, it's the same every night, really, in terms of the shape of the arrangement. So, and everything has to be in place, including geography of where you are on stage at any one moment, because of all lighting cues and video cues being, you know, programmed events that have to run have to go like clockwork, really.
Right.
So yes, it's an interesting, interesting way of doing shows that I have found very instructive, really, in terms of, you know, once you have all the framework in place, you can really get into the detail and the nuances in terms of delivery and the way you perform. It's kind of an interesting thing to have done for 2 years of my life, but at the end of this year, I shall never want to see that again for a while, because it's a lot of shows to do based
right.
on one kind of program content.
Sure. You're playing a few venues here in New England in October, including, I think, at the rather cheekily named Wang Theater. Do you, in Boston, do you remember your first performance in Boston?
Yes, it was at a place called the Boston Tea Party, a club operated by Don Law, who, along with Bill Graham, were the first two promoters to book Jethro Tull in 1969.
Right.
And, yeah, that was the start of a long relationship with that part of America, really. And I have to say it was an easy entry, because starting off in New England was not too much of a culture wrench.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we'd started off in Los Angeles or in certain other parts of America, it would have been, I think we would have spent probably 3 weeks just trying to get used to the way things were. So yeah, it was good to start off in with some degree of, you know, familiar culture, I think.
Sure.
Louisiana would have been a wrench. That would have been a tough cookie to start with.
Well, I'm sure you would have loved it. Prior to the release of Tab 2, it had been quite a while since you'd produced an album of new music. Had you taken a hiatus from songwriting, or were you writing songs but just not sharing them?
Well, we'd done a lot of we've been doing quite a lot of material, which was just individual songs that were new songs that we played from time to time just during the last two or three or four years. There was you know, frequent little pieces that we'd done. But there were four pieces, actually, from Tab 2, which began life as live performances and then were rewritten to incorporate into the Tab 2 material. Three of them were written for Tab 2. One of them was written in a different context, and then the lyrics and music were reworked because it was an easy shoehorn into the Tab 2 material. So we did have the benefit of playing quite a bit of Tab 2 live on stage before we got into the studio. I mean, almost 20 minutes of music were tried and tested as stage performances.
Right.
And, you know, we knew that they would work because we'd played them live, and on first listening, or first and only listening to the audiences who heard them, then, you know, there was a positive reaction that gave me confidence that, you know, that was one third down, two thirds to go in terms of material. So
right.
I went into it fairly confidently, thinking I can come up with an hour's worth of new material, which will be fairly plausible in terms of taking it on the road. The bigger question was, could we do justice to the original Thick as a Brick, which was a very, very hard album to recreate live.
Sure.
Well, dare I say, an impossible album, certainly back in 1972, to recreate live with only five of us, because there were a lot of overdubs that I did of playing different instruments, and many of which occurred at the same time. So it was impossible to do all that live on stage back then. The way it was recorded, these days we get pretty close to it, although there is a missing trumpet and a couple of other little sort of effects things that it was impossible to do live, simply because I don't have enough hands.
Right.
But we do, you know, really, as far as the audience are concerned, you can say it's kind of note for note the same arrangement, bar a couple of little missing tiny things that people probably wouldn't notice anyway.
Right.
Cool. I didn't until it came to the remixing of the original album, when I thought, well, bugger me, Stiff, that's a trumpet in there. I'd forgotten about the trumpet.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The obviously, you've got some, you know, a different group of musicians, and I'm wondering if there's anything you'd like people to know about this group. A couple of them have been touring with you before, but, you know, anything you'd like people to know about these guys that may not be apparent to the naked eye,
well,
you know, or ear.
All of them during the last 10 years or so have played with me, and indeed have been members of Jethro Tull. And Jethro Tull, you know, concerts billed simply as Jethro Tull. They've all done all that repertoire, so they're all pretty clued in on the bulk of the music. And, you know, out of the 28 members of Jethro Tull over the years, these are the current, you know, four or five other guys. I mean, there's an extra person who's not really one of the musicians as such, but he sings and mimes,
right,
and dances his way through the show. But, you know, the other guys have a very extensive knowledge of all the Jethro Tull repertoire. So it's, you know, comforting for me to know that I have people who can handle that huge variety, because it would be fair. It's not overtly critical, but it would be fair to say that, you know, many of the earlier members of the band would not be able to play that music. I mean, it'd be,
yeah,
be beyond them technically or beyond them stylistically. Because although in their different ways they were fine musicians who contributed enormously to the band at different points, they wouldn't have been able to execute those musical lines. And
mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, you have to these days, I think, if you're going to play the big picture from 68 to 2012, then you've got to be able to, you've really got to know your stuff, and you've also got to be very disciplined at learning, rehearsing, preparing the music before we get into the band rehearsal stage of things. Everybody's got to come in having done their homework and be, you know, 80% sorted in terms of technical proficiency.
Right.
And that's something that wasn't always easy to have with some of the guys whose preparation was perhaps a little more less disciplined. They maybe thought, well, we'll sort this out in rehearsal, or or in the first couple of shows, which of course is a no-no when you don't have paying punters come through the doors in order to watch you rehearse. So yeah, I appreciate having the guys who have that work ethic. You know, they really do prepare things ahead of time, which is good because the next show I have is in Iceland, in a little town in the north of Iceland called Akureyri, and when we you know, get off the plane there, we've actually got to know what it is we're playing, which is a completely different set, you know, for sort of best of tell material. But also we have to prepare for our Icelandic guests, which means, again, it's some material which we have to... we've all got to sort it out in advance. You know, we'll only have a, you know, half an hour at sound check to run through these things once.
Right.
So, it's good having... professionals. I think the thing is that rehearsal and preparation isn't a penalty. It's not something you should be sort of feeling, oh God, I've got to get up early and do this. You know, everybody actually loves doing it. You know, I think everybody gets a kick out of the challenge of deciphering a piece of new music that you've got to figure out, whether it's a piece of old Jethro Tull repertoire they haven't played before, or whether it's a piece of music, you know, for one of the guests, a piece of music written by somebody else and with which, of course, everybody's unfamiliar.
Right.
So it's I think those challenges are part of what makes it fun. And when you know that you can handle the bulk of the music, then I suppose you get hungry to look for new challenges, or at least some musicians do. Some are perfectly content just to go out and do no practice or rehearsal and just play the things they've played a million times in the past. But that's, I think, ultimately a bit too convenient, really, isn't it?
Yeah, a bit boring, maybe. Hey, unlike the original Tab and its successor, A Passion Play, which I guess we should call App, Tab 2 is comprised of individual tracks, obviously with a theme that's running through it. But did you consider writing another album-length piece, or do you think the time for projects like that is past?
Well, if you actually analyze what makes it up, the construction as you would buy it, you know, in terms of the DVD of Tab 2 is it has ID points in it, but it is recorded as an unbroken, unedited piece of continuous music for 53 minutes, not just the 20 minutes aside of Thick as a Brick 1. It is a continuous flow piece with lots of reiterations, developments, themes, harmonic patterns which occur on and off through the music and repeat sometimes, you know, two or three times. So there is a very, conceptual structure to Tab 2. The main difference is that in the digital age, making, you know, releasing this for the first time on a CD or a DVD, you have ID points, so you can treat it as individual tracks. And I tried to make sure that when we recorded it, we were able to create those little moments where the ID points were not... going to sound like you were just dropping the needle in the middle of a groove of music.
Mm-hmm.
When we came to re-release the remix and then re-release the remastered Thick as a Brick 1 album, I had to work all of that out in the way that we could create those ID points to break it into the sections, which are probably very similar, if not the same, as the specially edited DJ copies we did for US radio back in 1972, because we pressed a few hundred copies of the original Thick as a Brick album, which were banded copies. You know, they had the reels. The grooves of nothing, where you could put the needle in on the piece of silence and then a quick fade in or an edit into the next section of music. That was for disc jockeys to play convenient 3 or 4 minute chunks of Thick as a Brick back then in 72, when everybody had to play it off a record. There were turntables with records sitting on them in the radio stations.
Right.
So you had to make it easier. They couldn't just drop the record. They couldn't drop the needle in. I mean, it would sound horrible if you just put the needle in the middle of some flow of music. It would be an awful jump and a jar and a so we made those special copies back then, and that's how it was done when we came to make the iTunes edited versions where you can buy individual parts of Thick as a Brick 1 on iTunes in banded sections.
Yeah, yeah.
Or on Amazon for that matter. So you know, with the passing of time, you it's not that you construct the music particularly in a different way, but when it comes to the manufacturing or the final mastering and the manufacturing, then you have other options that you have to consider. There are bands like Pink Floyd who took the decision they didn't want to dismantle recordings like Dark Side of the Moon. They could only be available if you purchased the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not that prissy. I think people in this day and age should have that option. You know, they're familiar with the option from lots of other material, including the works of Mozart and Beethoven. You can buy it in convenient bite-sized portions. I think it's a bit perhaps a little arrogant to not allow people that choice when it comes to the conceptual rock music of artists like Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid I'm not a Luddite in that case. I'm more of a progressive who thinks we have to change our ways a little bit to offer people the option.
Freedom.
But it doesn't affect the way that I write the music in the first place.
Right, right. And hopefully they'll still be listening to it beginning to end as they should.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've finished writing a new album, which I wrote in January of this year, and that, too, involves lots of reprises, variations on and elements, but I chose to do it in a way where the whilst the music may still flow from one song to the other without any real studio silence, it's or any digital silence, put it that way. I have tried to make it slightly more effective in terms of song lengths and song structures. Partly because it's more of a rock album, and therefore in genre terms, I've tried for the most part to give sections of music a little more identity in terms of the structure and the arrangement. But you know, I think it's the way in which you work. And I there may be some people who listen to, you know, Tab 2 or the next album think, oh, he's running out of ideas, repeating himself there, he's using that chord sequence again, or that melody is coming up again. Well, of course it is, you bloody fool. That's just written like that on purpose.
Right, right.
that's reiteration, that's development, that's the tool of the music writer.
Sure.
That you you take your themes and represent them. It's the form of the concerto or the symphony that you try to present certain ideas and let them develop. They show their face again in a you know, perhaps wearing a different suit of clothes, but it's essentially and intentionally using some of the same musical ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
It may be complete repetition, or it may be a very carefully worked reuse and development of an earlier piece that's sitting there in real time 10 minutes before. But I have to say I enjoy working this way. It's tackling bigger projects, bigger ideas. But you know, if you're my age, what are you going to do? Are you going to sit down and peddle 3-minute convenient song length pieces till you die, or is it worth trying to bite into a bigger and perhaps more difficult piece of fruit? It's a real challenge. But you know, I think at my age, I'd rather go out tackling bigger things than either just going out and doing best of tours for what remains of my performing life. I'd rather give a crack to some more difficult ideas and musical structures, which is my job to make those accessible, not in terms of only listening to the music, but in terms of performing it live, where I have to find the ways to make that entertaining as a piece of rock theater.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. Speaking of theater, I wanted to mention that the current show is quite elaborate in terms of its multimedia presentation, which is a bit of a departure from some of your other more recent tours. I think people are going to very much enjoy, return to what I think some of the earlier Tull performances did so well, which is dazzling all the senses, not just the ears.
Yeah, well, it's structured in the way that it is, partly because of, you know, the real pragmatic issues of touring a show. That you know, if you've got to be able to jump on a plane and show up in, I don't know, in Japan or something, and play your show just as you did it two nights ago in Germany or wherever, then it's got to be practical. It's got to be movable. It's all got to be a lot of technology, and obviously you can't take with you vast numbers of props and scenery. So you have to kind of work with the elements that are available to you, that are things that you can travel with and work with. So, you know, there is just one props case. There is the production case. There is everybody probably has one or two check-in pieces of technical stuff, of equipment, and then their own personal belongings. But, you know, it's all stuff, you know, we can, typically we can get through from the entrance door to the baggage check-in area of an international airport without having to use trolleys or baggage handlers to get us there. We can physically roll our stuff through, and it's all legal aircraft size these days, because again, this is the reality of the world we live in. Impossible to be doing things with air freight and carnets in this day and age.
Yep.
I mean, it's just impossible to do that. You have to have three sets of equipment and allow for the time lag in shipping things in air freight terms, not to say the problems of immigration and customs and importation, which is a technical and difficult problem. But if you take it in personally and carry it with you, you have to work within the rules of the airlines, and the most draconian of them are the ones that set the bar for everything else. So, you know, we have to be able to shoehorn everything into 20 kilo conventional pieces of luggage, really. I mean, some of them are, you know, hard case, sort of armored cases for very delicate pieces of equipment, but, you know, we have to work within a 20 kilo maximum.
Right.
In America, that's, 50 pounds, being 23 kilos, which some airlines allow, but we have to be able to shed a few pounds in weight from everything and get it down to 20 kilos because of the airlines that will only allow that as a check-in piece. So, you know, we have to work within the practical restriction, but that's not something to be, you know, it's daunting, but it's a challenge. You know, I kind of like the challenges. You know, if airlines decided we had to work within 15 kilos, it wouldn't stop me touring the world and doing shows. I would just have to be I would have to tell everybody only pack one change of underwear.
Yeah, it's a bit of a puzzle to be solved, huh? Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to you about your lyrics. Certainly one of the things that has always drawn me to your work is the fact that you use very thoughtful, highly poetic lyrics, which are actually audible, and not just in the recordings, but in your live performances. In fact, in the Tab 2 special edition, you perform the album's lyrics without any music. I know you've said in the past that you're not really a fan of poetry with a capital P, but clearly lyrics are more important to you than they seem to be to many other artists. And I'm wondering, is that because you have a tighter tether to your troubadour minstrel roots? Is it that you have more to say? You know, certainly the Tab 2 album deals with, you know, many important topical subjects in your own way, homelessness and televangelism and militarism. That's something that I think has differentiated your work from the very beginning, and obviously something that that I'm sure you take pride in. Where does that come from? What is it in your educational or self-educational background that's enabled you to write, you know, such powerful lyrics?
Well, it's probably partly because of keeping away from the traditions and the accepted icons of literature and poetry. As a child and as a young adult, I didn't read that stuff. I mean, it's not because I suppose I could have got hold of it. I wanted to, but I just really shied away from things that I felt might unduly influence me. I really wanted to find my own way of expressing the very rich language of, you know, of my birthright. You know, I'm British. We speak English. We have a huge history of of poetic and thespian work, which is, I think, not something I want to be influenced by and try to emulate or equal, but I in my own way, I would like to make my own contemporary versions of structures of words that have meaning, that where I use the tools of my trade, you know. You know, simile, analogy, metaphor. These are the plumber's tools. You know, I show up for work with a tool bag, and I don't have wrenches and hammers and saws in there. What I have is the grammatical structure and the vocabulary of my language. I obviously couldn't write write songs in French or in Italian. There's a fair bit of Latin, come to think of it, in the forthcoming album for 2014. In fact, I will have to spend some time with a Latin scholar just to check all of my Latin references. But it's stuff that's out there. Make use of it. Don't be afraid. I mean, the greater part of pop and rock lyrics, I mean, it's an incredibly small vocabulary.
Right.
And
Be My Baby Please kind of gets old after a while.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I have great admiration for those people who have coined the simplest turns of phrase and given them life and put them into that small pantheon of musical and lyrical testimony to the creativity of people working in simple forms. It's brilliant if you can do that. And some people can do it. They do it once or twice and don't necessarily have a high volume of output or not able to repeat their best work. But, you know, I suppose I'm more inclined to move on and use other words, other structures, other forms, other references, but there are some social, religious, political issues that will keep coming back to me when I write a song. I just try not to keep writing the same song over and over. So I shan't be writing another song about the iniquities of investment bankers. You know, been there, done that, time to move on. But you can bet your bottom dollar, pun fully intended, there'll be another song that refers to issues of economics and or world trade or something that touches upon not dissimilar issues.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope I'm able to do it in a different way.
Yeah, I'm sure you had some people scrambling for their Latin dictionaries to look up non est mea culpa.
Well, yes, and that's a tricky one because it is actually an aberration. Non est mea culpa, it should really be, technically, it should be mea culpa non est. But it is widely expressed with the verb in front of the noun. But in true traditional, you know, in classical Latin, it should be mea culpa non est. It doesn't scan well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just I tried singing it that way. I even recorded it that way and listened to it. I thought, oh, fuck this. I'm going back to the easy version, which is much easier to sing. If you're going to sing Latin phrases, you've got to be you've either got to build the song around the phrase or you've got to maybe bend it a little bit. So I have spent quite a bit of time in that's just the one Latin reference in tab 2, but there's quite a few in more recent material, which I have to make sure it sings well. And
right.
That's a part of the art of writing lyrics, is that they're not like poetry. Poetry, you read off the page. Once in a blue moon, you hear performance poetry where somebody reads the words out loud. But song lyrics are there to be sung, and they are there to be performed, and therefore it's quite a different, I imagine, quite a different thing to do to write rock lyrics, pop lyrics, because it's very much about how they sing,
right.
how they come off the CD, the DVD, the gramophone record, whatever it is. It's got to sing. It has to sing well. Ugly phrases that may look fine on the paper, but just don't don't sing well will remain ugly phrases, and so they might be perfectly okay in the context of a piece of written word, but that's not what I'm about. I'm not a poetry writer, I'm a song lyric writer. On which subject, my friend, I'm going to have to leave you because I'm 5 minutes behind time. Ooh, 10 minutes behind time for my next interview. But delightful talking to you, and I look forward to seeing you in Boston before too long.
Likewise. Well, thank you for your time, Ian.
Brilliant. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye now. This interview was conducted on May 28th, 2013, and recorded with the help of the good people at The Studio, 45 Casco Street in Portland, Maine. Portland's number one resource for all things audio since 1981. Ian Anderson will be performing Thick as a Brick and Thick as a Brick 2 together in their entireties on 3 dates this autumn in New England. October 4th at Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut, October 12th at the Wang Theater in Boston, and October 13th at the State Theater in Portland, Maine.